From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Clark is not only one of the key people testifying to the September 11th Commission. His accusations have been the basis for many of the questions posed to members of the Bush and Clinton administrations. Clark served as the counterterrorism chief in both administrations. In his new book, Against All Enemies, he contends that before September 11th, the Bush administration failed to adequately respond to warnings that an al-Qaeda attack was imminent. He also says that the Bush administration invaded Iraq in spite of the fact there was no evidence linking it to al-Qaeda. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear the interview I recorded with Richard Clark. Richard Clark, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House officials continued today to attack charges leveled by former anti-terrorism advisor Richard Clark, whose new book is critical of the president. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The administration is trying to counter Clark's allegations by using his own prior statements against him, specifically a briefing Clark gave to reporters back in August of 2002. Press Secretary Scott McClellan formally identified Clark as the anonymous briefer on that day, and he highlighted Clark's statement then that there was no plan regarding al-Qaeda that Clinton administration officials passed on to the Bush White House.
Dick Clark, in his own words, provides a point-by-point rebuttal of what he now asserts. This shatters the cornerstone of Mr. Clark's assertions.
Clark later responded, saying that in 2002, he was an administration official putting the best spin on the situation. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court heard a constitutional challenge today to the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. The pledge existed for more than 60 years without any reference to God, but the words were added by Congress in 1954. The case was brought by a California atheist who objects to his daughter being exposed to the religious reference in public school. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Acting as his own lawyer, Michael Newdow told the justices, "I have the right as her father not to have her raise her hand and say her father is wrong." Justice Ginsburg, "But no child has to say the pledge." Answer, "It's coercion, though, a huge imposition on a small child to ask her to refuse." Justice Souter, "What do you make of the argument that the affirmation under God in the midst of this civic exercise is so tepid, so diluted and far from prayer that it's beneath the constitutional radar screen? The argument is that the religious content is close to disappearing." Answer, "That's not the view I take. Every time I hear the pledge, it's like being slapped in the face. We don't need the words under God in the pledge. We got through two world wars and the Depression without it." Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Members of the Spanish royal family led a state funeral today in Madrid for the 190 people killed in the March 11th train bombings. After the ceremony, Spain's incoming Prime Minister José Luis Zapatero met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Secretary of State Colin Powell, who tried to persuade him to keep Spanish troops in Iraq. A senior aide to Zapatero said the Prime Minister insisted that his country's 1,300 troops would come home. Meanwhile, a Spanish judge has charged two more suspects in connection with the bombings. The suspects, a Moroccan man and his stepsister, were arrested over the weekend. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 15 points to close at 10,048 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 7 points. It closed at 1,909. This is NPR News. The European Union has imposed a fine of more than $600 million against Microsoft Corporation, saying the giant software maker abused its monopoly on Windows software. Microsoft said the EU decision was unwarranted and ill-considered, adding that it would appeal. The EU's antitrust office said its investigation found that Microsoft tried to force competitors out of its window-related markets and was still engaging in illegal behavior. The 19-year-old woman who says basketball star Kobe Bryant raped her last summer at a Colorado hotel has wrapped up testimony about her sex life. The woman answered questions for more than 3 hours in the hearing, which was closed to reporters and the public. NPR's Jeff Brady reports from Denver.
The judge is trying to determine whether information about the woman's sex life should be allowed as evidence in the upcoming trial. Colorado's Rape Shield law sets a high bar for introducing such evidence. The judge must decide whether it's relevant to the case. The basketball star contends the encounter at an Eagle, Colorado hotel was consensual. His attorneys say they hope to prove that injuries the woman suffered may have occurred while having sex with someone other than Bryant. The woman sat just a few feet from Bryant in the courtroom. This is the first time the two have come face to face since the alleged rape occurred. The closed-door hearing will resume Thursday, when Bryant's lawyers will ask the judge to throw out evidence they say was gathered improperly. If found guilty, Bryant faces up to life in prison. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The Commerce Department says that sales of newly built houses rose sharply in February, growing by a stronger-than-expected 5.8%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Richard Clark, President Bush's former counterterrorism chief. His new book, Against All Enemies, contends that before September 11th, the Bush administration failed to respond to warnings that al-Qaeda was preparing a major attack. His accusations have been on the front pages of newspapers, debated on the talk shows, and, of course, discussed at the September 11th commission hearings. He was one of today's witnesses. The commission was created by Congress to investigate the circumstances surrounding the terrorist attacks, America's preparedness for the attacks, and its immediate response. Richard Clark was appointed by President Clinton as the first national coordinator for security, infrastructure protection, and counterterrorism in 1998. He continued in that position under President Bush, and in 2001, he became the president's special advisor for cyberspace security and chair of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Board. He resigned early last year. Clark also served in the administrations of Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. I spoke with Richard Clark yesterday morning. What warnings did you feel you had that a big terrorist attack was imminent shortly before September 11th?
Well, Terry, for about 2 months, more like 10 weeks, the CIA director had been calling me and had also been briefing President Bush every morning, saying that there was increasing intelligence evidence that al-Qaeda was planning a major attack. Now, he didn't know where. In fact, the CIA analysts thought it was most likely going to be in Saudi Arabia or Israel. But I asked him, could you rule out that it would be in the United States? And he said no. So we did initiate some steps in the United States as best we could to raise defenses.
What did you do?
Well, we issued warnings through the FBI system to 18,000 police departments, state and local. We issued warnings to the airlines through the FAA and to airports. We issued warnings to the federal law enforcement agencies, Customs, Immigration, Secret Service, Coast Guard, and told them that an al-Qaeda terrorist attack was imminent and that they should take appropriate measures. We also, in case it was overseas, told the Defense Department, which went on an increased alert, defensive posture, and we told the State Department, which increased the security of its embassies overseas.
What did you try to tell the president and other people in defense within the Bush administration about imminent al-Qaeda attacks?
Well, I knew that the president was being told every morning by George Tenet, the CIA director, that this was happening. I had asked early on, I think 2 or 3 days into the Bush administration in January, to have a cabinet-level meeting, following which we could have a presidential meeting. And I was told, well, no, we're not going to do that. You're not going to get to see the president on terrorism. We're going to have a policy development process and review terrorist policy in general. And we'll do that in a couple of months. We'll start at the deputy secretary level. And that process dragged on until September 4th, when finally we had the cabinet-level meeting that I had requested urgently in writing very early in the administration, 3 days into the administration.
What is your interpretation of that slow process that prevented you from actually speaking directly to the president and prevented you from getting to the top with the analysis you had about the need for more attention to al-Qaeda?
Well, I think if you look at what the president himself said to Bob Woodward, the Washington Post reporter who wrote the book Bush at War, in an interview with Woodward, the president says, "This was not on the top of my list or my national security team. I was not on point. I did not feel a sense of urgency about al-Qaeda." Now, frankly, how he could not feel a sense of urgency given the fact that he was being briefed every day by CIA about an impending attack, I still don't understand.
Some people have speculated that because al-Qaeda was a priority of the Clinton administration, it was dismissed by the Bush administration, which didn't want to be associated with anything that seemed Clinton-esque. Do you give any credibility to that?
You know, it's an awful thing to believe, but there's some reason to believe that, and here it is. The Clinton people, the president himself and the national security advisor, Sandy Berger, and others said to the incoming team in a very civil, polite way, even after the election fiasco in Florida, there are three issues that you have to focus on. One is al-Qaeda. Two is the Arab-Israeli peace process. And three is the process we've created to negotiate with North Korea about their nuclear weapons program. Somehow, all three of those issues slipped to the bottom of the agenda when the Clinton people left and the Bush people took over. And the issues that were on the top were Star Wars, the anti-ballistic missile program, Iraq, relations with Russia. These were issues that the Bush people had developed as their agenda over the course of the preceding year. And they were undeterred in that set of priorities for, well, at least until September 11th on terrorism, and on the Arab-Israeli peace process and North Korea, they were deterred for even longer.
What do you think the Bush administration could have done, if anything, to prevent September 11th from happening with the information that had been coming in?
Well, I don't know that anything could have been done. And it's very facile, I think, to say that if this or that happened, we could have prevented September 11th. We'll never know. But I do like to contrast the months prior to September 11th during the Bush administration with the month prior to the millennium rollover in December 1999 in the Clinton administration, because they're similar. In both time frames, George Tenet and the CIA were reporting that there might be a large-scale al-Qaeda attack in the near future. In December 1999, President Clinton ordered his national security advisor, Sandy Berger, to hold meetings, if not daily, at least every other day, with the Attorney General, with the head of the FBI, the Secretary of Defense, the head of the CIA, and get daily or every other day reports from them on what they were doing to stop this possible attack. Now, when that kind of thing happens, when the Attorney General or the FBI director knows that he or she has to go back to the White House the next day and report on what they have done, they go back to their departments and they shake the trees. And that ripples throughout the department, throughout the FBI. And it did in December 1999. One of the things that happened as a result of the warnings and alerts in December 1999 was that the customs agencies, police was on high alert, and a customs agent in Washington state saw a suspicious character, and she chased him, and she arrested him. And it turned out that this fellow was going to be part of an attack team that was going to attack and blow up Los Angeles Airport. Now, there were three planned attacks around the millennium, and as you know, none of them took place. Some of that's because of good police work, good intelligence work, and some of it's because of luck. Now, contrast that with June, July, and August of 2001, when similar warnings were coming in. But the president did not say, I want to chair a meeting on this to find out how you're stopping the attack. He did not order his national security advisor to do so. They left it at my level, the staff level. Now, there's a lot I can do at the staff level, and I did. I sent out the warnings I talked about. But it's not quite the same as the regular drumbeat of having to go into the White House as a cabinet member or the head of an agency and say what you've done to stop the attack.
Are you suggesting that you think the Bush administration basically had blinders on, they saw only what was on their agenda and didn't see anything that wasn't on their agenda, no matter how urgent that other thing may have been?
Well, I think there's a good case to be made for that. You know, if the FBI director had been dragged over and the attorney general had been dragged over every day to say, what are you doing? And if they had gone back to their department and shaken the trees, they would have found out that buried in the FBI there was knowledge that two al-Qaeda members, two terrorists, had infiltrated the United States. That information had not reached the top of the FBI. It had not reached me. But if we had had a process where the cabinet-level people, the attorney general and the FBI director, were being asked every day in a meeting in the White House, what are you doing? They probably would have found that information. Now, if you had that information, what would you have done? Probably put their names and pictures on the front page of every paper in the country and on America's Most Wanted. We probably would have found them. Now, if we had found two of the hijackers, could we have stopped the entire attack? We'll never know.
My guest is Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief in the Clinton and Bush administrations. His new book is called Against All Enemies. Our interview was recorded yesterday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Clark. He was National Security Coordinator under Presidents Clinton and President Bush. He also worked in the first Bush administration and the Reagan administration on security. And his new book, which I'm sure you've been hearing about, is called Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. What you had warned the Bush administration that al-Qaeda was planning a major attack. You didn't know that it would be in the United States, but you thought it was coming, and you think that they virtually ignored the warnings. After September 11th, did the president, did Donald Rumsfeld, did Wolfowitz, did anybody who you think had basically ignored your warnings come to you and say, well, you were right?
Well, to say they virtually ignored the warnings.
Did I overstate that?
Perhaps a little.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that I was sending out alerts. They knew that I was holding meetings. They didn't think it was important enough for them to hold meetings. So the president never held a meeting with the attorney general and the other cabinet members on the impending al-Qaeda attack.
Mm-hmm.
He got these briefings every morning from George Tenet, and on one occasion he said, apparently, to Condoleezza Rice, I don't want to just SWAT flies, meaning I don't want to just go after one terrorist here and one terrorist there. I want a strategy. So on one of these days, one of these many, many days, when he was told there was an impending al-Qaeda attack, he did make a comment that he wanted a strategy. Condoleezza Rice then called me and said, well, this is what the president wants, and I reminded her that I had a strategy, a plan, which we had shown her, in fact, before the inauguration, and I had been hoping to get her to hold a meeting on. And she said, well, we'll get to it.
So after September 11th, did anybody in the Bush administration come to you and say, you were right?
Not that I remember.
After September 11th, you were told to investigate connections between Iraq and al-Qaeda. You said there were none. You did the report. You found no connections. And you say that the president then said to you, Iraq, Saddam, find out if there's a connection. You said he said this in a very intimidating way, as if you should come back with that answer. You wrote another report. It got bounced back, and the aide giving you back the report said, wrong answer, do it again.
Well, Terry, the chronology is a little bit different, but essentially that's correct. On September 12th, we were still in the crisis room, in the situation room, and the president wandered in and wandered about and saw me and pulled me aside with three of my staff and closed the door in a conference room. Now, the president apparently now says he doesn't remember this ever happening. I have these three other staff members who were with me who have all said to newspapers and television media that, yes, indeed, it did happen. So first thing is, it did happen, even if the president has a senior moment about it. What did he ask? The White House now says that if the meeting took place, what he was asking was merely that I do due diligence, that I look into all possibilities, that I not assume it was just al-Qaeda. Well, that's not exactly what happened. What happened was he spoke about Iraq, not all possibilities, not Iran, not Hezbollah, not other terrorist groups. He spoke to me in very firm, almost angry tones about the need for me to write a paper about Iraq's role or links. And I said, well, there aren't any significant links between al-Qaeda and Iraq. We've looked at this issue before. We looked at the issue of Iraqi involvement with al-Qaeda before the attacks on 9/11. And he was very upset by that answer. So we then went off and wrote a memo. And we cleared that memo with the CIA, and we cleared that memo with the FBI. And we sent it up the chain to the National Security Advisor and her deputy. The memo came back very quickly with the instructions that we should redo it and update it. And we said, well, wait a minute, how can we update it? It's brand new. It's got all the latest information. We did it again. We sent it back up, and they never showed it to the president because it concluded that there was no Iraqi involvement.
Why do you think it was never shown to the president?
Well, you know, my impression is that the people around the president don't show him things that don't accord with their views or his views. This is not a White House that is interested in analysis, pros and cons, evaluation. They kind of have the conclusions, and they want only information that supports the conclusions. The conclusions are received wisdom.
You have worked for four administrations, the Reagan administration, the first President Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and the current Bush administration. Have reports that you have handed in ever been treated that way? Have you ever seen information treated in the kind of selective way that you're describing?
No, I think this administration is unique in that it really rejects the kind of analysis that the professional intelligence analysis and the professional policy analysis that I grew up in the government doing and that every administration wanted. You know, before going into a war with Iraq, for example, one might have wanted an analysis that said, show me all the evidence that they are an imminent threat to the United States. Let's see the case for that. Let's see the case against that. That was never done. Assuming we go into Iraq and we try to set up a Jeffersonian democracy there, what are, and there are obviously pluses if we can do that, what are the minuses? What are the unintended consequences in the Islamic world and in the war on terrorism of doing an invasion of Iraq? That was never done. Because even if we succeed over the long term, and it will take a long time, to make Iraq a democracy. In the meantime, the more immediate effects of our having gone into Iraq are that we have radicalized even further a generation of young Muslims from Morocco to Indonesia. that we have given great fuel and ammunition to the terrorist movement.
You write that after September 11th, you realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq. Since the beginning of the administration, indeed well before, they had been pressing for a war with Iraq. My friends in the Pentagon had been telling me that word was we would be invading Iraq sometime in 2002. You're saying that Iraq was on the agenda from the very start, and before September 11th, what were the reasons that were given at administration meetings for paying that much attention to Iraq, and were the actual discussions about invading Iraq before September 11th?
There were discussions about what to do with Iraq, and among the options discussed were options to invade. But this goes back to even before these people in the Pentagon and in the vice president's office, even before they came into the government, even before Bush was inaugurated. They were talking publicly in meetings in Washington. They were writing monograms and distributing them around about why we needed to reshape the Middle East by knocking off Saddam Hussein, going in and building a democracy there. They had this sort of messianic view that the United States, as the great superpower, could just put its hand into the middle of the Middle East and rip out a regime and remold a country, and then that would have ripple effects throughout the Middle East. And then, after September 11th, the president signed what's called a National Security Presidential Directive, an NSPD. In the National Security Presidential Directive, he instructed the Pentagon to begin planning for a war with Iraq right after September 11th, even though the CIA and FBI were telling him that September 11th had nothing to do with Iraq.
Did you express skepticism about invading Iraq or focusing on Iraq at any meetings before September 11th?
Well, I wasn't invited to most of those meetings, Terry. After September 11th, and including on September 11th, I said, you must be joking. I mean, this has got nothing to do with al-Qaeda. We've just been attacked. America's just been attacked in a very major way. We need to have all of our energy, all of our resources, on the war on terrorism. Why divert resources into something else, particularly into something else that will only strengthen the terrorists?
Richard Clark served as the counterterrorism chief in the administrations of Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. Our interview was recorded yesterday. We'll hear the rest of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, smoothies, and cultured soy. 10% of profits are donated to support environmental causes and family farms. Details at stonyfield.com. And from Knopf, publisher of The Fabric of the Cosmos, the new book by Brian Greene, author of The Elegant Universe. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief in the Clinton and Bush administrations. He says the invasion of Iraq has actually made the U.S. more vulnerable. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview I recorded yesterday morning with Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief in the Clinton and Bush administrations. He also served under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. In his new book, Against All Enemies, Clark contends that before September 11th, the Bush administration failed to adequately respond to warnings that al-Qaeda was planning an attack. In response to the attacks, we invaded Iraq, in spite of the fact there was no evidence connecting it to al-Qaeda. Clark's book has been used by the September 11th Commission in the questioning of witnesses. Clark was one of today's witnesses. You say that after September 11th, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld complained that there were no decent targets for bombing in Afghanistan. And we did end up bombing in Afghanistan. What is your interpretation of what he meant by that? There are no decent targets for bombing in Afghanistan.
I think he, and actually the president too, wanted to demonstrate American power after September 11th. They wanted to say, you can't pull on Superman's cape. Well, we were all willing to think about demonstrating American power. The question was using it in a way that made sense, using it in a way that strengthened our defenses, not just using it for the hell of it. And by suggesting that there weren't enough things to bomb in Afghanistan, but there were in Iraq, the Secretary of Defense seemed to me to be saying, let's just blow things up for the hell of it to prove to people that we're big and tough.
Now, you say in your book that you think invading Iraq has actually increased the problem of terrorism. How?
Well, in three ways. First of all, it's costing us $180 billion in the first 2 years, and may be even more than that. That money could have been used to reduce our vulnerabilities here at home. In the wake of the Madrid bombing of the trains recently, people have realized what's been true all along, that our railroads in the United States, our subways, our commuter rails, are not protected. Well, many things in the United States are not protected. There's a long list of vulnerabilities which we could reduce. It would cost money. We're not spending that money reducing those vulnerabilities very much. There's some token efforts. There should have been an all-out national effort akin to the Apollo project or the Manhattan Project. But we didn't do that, and in large part we didn't do that because the money that would have been necessary is being spent on Iraq. So that's the first thing. It's costing us the alternative of reducing our vulnerabilities. Secondly, actual military and intelligence assets that were in Afghanistan looking for al-Qaeda, looking for bin Laden, were removed and sent to Iraq. Now, in the last few weeks, they have been returned. But that's 2 years too late. 2 years during which al-Qaeda has morphed into a hydra-headed organization with independent organizations, independent cells throughout the world, like the group in Madrid. So we didn't go after al-Qaeda the way we should have. And we didn't secure Afghanistan. We went into Afghanistan in a very slow way after September 11th. A few special forces troops were put up north with the Northern Alliance to fight the Taliban. We did not send people into where we thought bin Laden was for almost 2 months, during which, of course, he escaped. And then we only deployed 11,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Let's compare that. There are more police in Manhattan, not the city of New York, but just Manhattan. There are more police in Manhattan than the United States put troops into Afghanistan. And yet we were supposed to secure and stabilize the country so that never again could it be a base for terrorism. We were supposed to be draining the swamp. Well, we haven't. And one of the reasons we haven't is that we withheld forces that should have been going into Afghanistan. We withheld them for the war on Iraq.
One of the things that you just said is that money that is being spent on Iraq should have been spent on homeland security. Are you saying that you think we're actually pretty vulnerable in the United States to another terrorist attack?
I think since September 11th, we've done a great deal to improve the security of passenger aircraft. There are many, many other things that need to be secured. Container shipping, chemical plants, trains. Lots of things where there are plans and there are projects and there are very frustrated people in the Department of Homeland Security who would like to be reducing these vulnerabilities, but they can't get the money. Terry, there's a third way in which going into Iraq hurt the war on terrorism.
Go ahead.
The third way is that Al-Qaeda had been saying, bin Laden had been saying, that the United States is the new crusader, the new Westerner come to occupy an Arab country, an oil-rich Arab country. And we did exactly that. We did exactly what bin Laden said we would do. We invaded and occupied an oil-rich Arab country that had not been threatening us. And the sights on Arab television of American troops fighting in Iraq and now occupying Iraq have infuriated Arab opinion. The Pew Charitable Trust does opinion polling, very reliable opinion polling, in countries such as Morocco and Jordan and Turkey, Indonesia, Pakistan. Many of those countries, the government, at least, is our friend, and we consider them allies and we consider them moderates. And yet, the opinion polls now show that up to 90% of people in those countries either hate the United States or have a very negative opinion of the United States. Osama bin Laden is a very popular figure in some of those countries. The most often given name to new children in Pakistan after 9/11 was Osama. So we played right into their hands by invading and occupying, without any provocation, a Muslim country. And at the very time when we should have been doing the opposite, we should have been embracing our Islamic friends and saying, work with us to have a counterweight, an ideological counterweight to Al-Qaeda. They won't do that now with us because many of these governments don't want to be seen to be working too closely with us now in the Islamic world. We can't just arrest and kill terrorists. Even Donald Rumsfeld figured that out. In his internal memo in the Pentagon, which leaked, he said, it may be the case that we're turning out new terrorists faster than we're killing and arresting them. He's right. We are. And we have to win the war for ideas. And we can't do that as long as we are reviled by occupying a country like Iraq.
Say you became president tomorrow and you had the power to change policies, change our approach to the war on terrorism, change what we're doing in Iraq. What do you think could be done? Go ahead.
This is the real problem, Terry. President Bush, by putting us in Iraq, has created a fait accompli. And whether he stays in office or some other person, Senator Kerry or whoever, replaces him, there's still going to be this situation of the United States owning Iraq and having 100+ thousand troops there and being responsible for its future. So no matter who's president, they have that problem. We should never have been put in this position, and it's going to take an awful lot of work to get us out of this position in a way that preserves our security interests.
My guest is Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief in the Clinton and Bush administrations. His new book is called Against All Enemies. Our interview was recorded yesterday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Clark, and he served as National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism under Presidents Clinton and in the current Bush administration. He also held security positions under the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. Richard Clark, when did you resign from the Bush administration?
In February of last year.
In one way, I should be asking you, why did you resign? Why didn't you stay? And in another way, I should be asking you, why did you wait so long to resign, given how wrong-headed you thought the Bush administration policies were?
Well, I probably should have resigned earlier. I kept hoping that the war with Iraq would not happen. I had asked to work on other issues. I had asked to work on the issue of cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection. And I thought I was getting a lot done in that field, which needed to be done. So I thought I was making a difference in an area. But the more and more that I saw where the administration was going and the fact that they couldn't be stopped by rational argument, and Colin Powell and others were not going to win the day, we were going to go to war, and largely in a unilateral way, I felt I had to end my career, and I was at the 30-year point of federal service, so I decided to leave. I was replaced by, among others, a fellow named Rand Beers, with whom I had worked with him for 25 years, in the State Department and the White House. He had worked in the Reagan White House and the first Bush White House and the Clinton White House. And so he started working on the terrorist account, and shortly thereafter, he too resigned and quit the government because he thought we weren't doing enough on the war on terrorism, and we were making it worse by the war on Iraq.
Let me read something you say about President Bush in your book. You write, "When he focused, he asked the kind of questions that revealed a bumper sticker description of the problem. Once he had that, he could put energy behind a drive to achieve his goal. The problem was that many of the important issues, like terrorism, like Iraq, were laced with important subtlety and nuance. These issues needed analysis, and Bush and his inner circle had no real interest in complicated analyses on the issues they cared about. They already knew the answers. It was received wisdom." Let's get back to what you're saying about President Bush here, that he had a bumper sticker description of problems.
Well, I think one of my favorite quotes from President Bush is, quote, "I don't do nuance," unquote. That's his self-description. And, you know, many of these problems are very nuanced, technical, detailed kinds of things that you can't reduce to a bumper sticker slogan like fight the war on terrorism. And it takes attention, it takes time, it takes analysis, and they're not too fond of analysis.
What do you hope your testimony to the September 11th Commission will accomplish?
Well, I think, for one thing, it will set the record straight about what the Clinton administration did and did not do, set the record straight about what the Bush administration did and did not do. I mean, you know, the Clinton administration is not blameless here. And recent press coverage of my book has focused on my criticism of the Bush administration, but that's one chapter in the book. There's a lot of blame to go around. The Clinton administration did accomplish some things which are not widely known, but it also failed in some areas. Among the things it did, which are not widely known, is it did retaliate militarily for terrorist attacks against Iraq, against Al-Qaeda, which the previous Bush administration and the previous Reagan administration had not done. We had hundreds of Americans killed during the Reagan administration in Beirut, and there was no military retaliation against the terrorists. Hundreds of Americans killed by Libya in Pan Am 103 in the Bush administration, and there was no military retaliation against the terrorists. So Clinton did use military retaliation. He effectively stopped Iraqi-sponsored terrorism against the United States. He effectively stopped Iranian-sponsored terrorism against the United States. He prevented Al-Qaeda from taking over Bosnia when it was trying to do so. He stopped the attacks in the Millennium period. He stopped many Al-Qaeda attacks. But he did not eliminate Al-Qaeda. Why? It's easy for us now, after 9/11, to say that we should have done this or that beforehand. But when Clinton left office, fewer than 50 Americans had been killed by Al-Qaeda over the course of 8 years. Contrast that to the figures I just gave you for the terrorist deaths under Reagan and Bush. A lot of people thought that Al-Qaeda was a kind of nuisance-level problem. Clinton didn't. His administration was working hard to go after Al-Qaeda. It didn't do some of the things that it might have done. For example, it didn't bomb all of the infrastructure, all of the terrorist camps. It did once bomb in Afghanistan, but it didn't go back and bomb and bomb and bomb and destroy the terrorist camps. It should have done that.
In terms of the Clinton administration and its attempts to destroy al-Qaeda, you're very angry about the distraction of the impeachment process and how much attention was paid by the government to the Monica Lewinsky scandal. You write, Clinton was weakened by continued political attack. He couldn't get the CIA, the Pentagon, and FBI to act sufficiently to deal with the threat. To what extent do you think that the impeachment process hindered the United States' ability to stop the threat of terrorism, or to at least decrease that threat?
After the two U.S. embassies were attacked in August of 1998, President Clinton responded with a military retaliation against al-Qaeda camps. And instead of the Congress and the media and the American people saying, yes, that's what we want, use military force against terrorists, what happened was a wave of criticism of Clinton. The Republicans and many in the right-wing media said what the president was trying to do was to divert attention from his own personal problems in the Lewinsky investigation. They recalled a movie called Wag the Dog. And you remember that movie had the following scenario. A president in trouble politically decides to use military force to divert attention, and he makes up a reason to invade Albania. And so after Clinton attacked the camps, he was accused of wagging the dog. In other words, using military force when it wasn't necessary in order to divert attention. Well, after you've used military force once and you get that kind of reaction, let's just say you're not precluded from doing it again, but the threshold is raised. It becomes more difficult for the president to decide to do it again. And frankly, Terry, if anybody has wagged the dog here, I think it's not Bill Clinton. It's George Bush. Because just as in the movie, when we made up a reason to invade Albania, I'd say we'd made up a reason to invade Iraq.
My guest is Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief in the Clinton and Bush administrations. His new book is called Against All Enemies. Our interview was recorded yesterday. We'll hear more of it after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Clark, and he served as the National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism under the administrations of President Clinton and President Bush. He also served in the in security positions under President Reagan and the first President Bush. His new book is called Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror, and it's quite critical of the Bush administration. Let's look at some of the criticisms that the Bush administration and other people who support the administration are leveling at you. One of them is that this is obviously timed to the presidential election, and that you have political motives in doing this now.
Okay, let's take that apart. There are two things they say. One, the timing by releasing it in March. In the beginning of the presidential election, is obviously political. I turned this book into the White House last year because as a former White House official, they have to review it for security content. They took 3 months to go through it and get back to me. This book could have been out last year. It's their choice that it's coming out now, not mine. The second thing, Dan Bartlett, one of their spokesmen, said this book is Dick Clark's attempt to get a high-level position in the Kerry administration. And they pointed out that I am a friend of Rand Beers, who used to work in the Bush White House doing terrorism, and who is now working for John Kerry. Well, they're right about that. I am a friend of Rand Beers. I was his friend when he worked in the Reagan White House. I was his friend when he worked in the Bush White House, number one. And I was his friend when he worked in the Bush White House, number two. And I am his friend now when he is Kerry's national security advisor. Do I want a job in the Kerry administration? No. And let me say, for the record, if John Kerry gets elected and offers me a job, I will thank him very much and decline. This is not about me getting a job. This is about the facts getting out to the American people.
Is it Beers who you are co-teaching a course with at Harvard? Because that has been another criticism.
It is. And, you know, I'm not going to run away from a friend of 25 years because he happens to be doing what they apparently think is dishonorable and working for John Kerry.
And here's something that has been disputed. You say in your book that it's just a fable that under the Clinton administration, the Sudanese government offered to arrest bin Laden and hand him over in chains to FBI agents, but Washington rejected it because the Clinton administration didn't see bin Laden as important or couldn't find anywhere to put him on trial. So you're saying, oh, that's a fable, that never happened. And some of your critics are saying, oh, that did happen, and the Clinton administration missed a great opportunity because they could have gotten bin Laden as a prisoner.
Yeah, I think we have to go back and look at the history of the time to see whether or not this is true. The man who was running Sudan at the time, Hassan al-Turabi, was himself, in effect, a terrorist. He supported terrorism against Egypt. He supported terrorism against other countries. He had invited terrorists from all over the world to set up shop in Khartoum. He also had a close personal relationship with bin Laden. They often dined in the evening together. Bin Laden would go horseback riding with his son. Bin Laden had given his efforts a great deal of money, and they were ideological soulmates. Turabi, using Egyptian terrorists, tried to kill the president of Egypt while he was visiting Ethiopia. This resulted in UN sanctions against Sudan for being a terrorist state sponsor. Terry, it's very difficult to get the UN, particularly back then, to pass sanctions on a country because it's a terrorist state sponsor. Now, this is the government that people are now in their revisionist history saying would have taken their dear friend, put him in chains, and handed him over to the FBI. They didn't offer to do that. There were discussions from time to time because they were trying to get us off their back. But they knew how to turn him over. In fact, when the United States found Carlos the Jackal, that terrorist, in Sudan and informed the French, the Sudanese very readily went out, found him, put him in chains, brought him to the airport and gave him to the French. If they had wanted to do that with bin Laden, they would have done that. But in fact, they had no interest in doing it because they agreed with bin Laden. They were part of his international movement.
Now, you are familiar with al-Qaeda not just as a national security expert. You are familiar with al-Qaeda as a former target. They had targeted you for assassination. And this was, what years were you a target?
Well, there were a series of reports. And, you know, in retrospect, I'm not sure that those reports were true. But the CIA did come to me in, I think, 1999, and say that they had information that al-Qaeda had put a contract out on me. And that kind of brings it home that they can operate in the United States. I always believed that, but the FBI never was able to identify a terrorist cell in the United States by al-Qaeda, even though we kept telling them to look harder because we thought they were there.
And what did you do to protect yourself?
Well, I can't go into too much of that. The president ordered Secret Service to provide me with additional security, and they did, and they're a very, very effective organization. Secret Service is probably the most effective federal agency, but even they say that there's only so much they can do to protect someone if the enemy is willing to sacrifice their life in the attack.
On September 11th, when you first heard the news about the attacks, you had been preparing for attacks. You thought they were coming. You had warned about them, but you didn't know if they would happen in the United States, and you certainly didn't know what shape they would take. So what was your first reaction when you knew, okay, this is it, this is the big one, and here's what actually happened, here's the shape it took?
My initial reaction was, how much more of it is there? Are there going to be simultaneous attacks overseas? Are there going to be follow-on attacks? So for the first several days, and indeed for the first several weeks, we were looking to increase security quickly and prevent follow-on attacks or further attacks, even though we recognized that this had been the big one that we knew was coming, and we had been unable to prevent it.
Richard Clark, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Clark served as counterterrorism chief in the administrations of Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. His new book is called Against All Enemies. He testified today before the September 11th commission. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Animal Crackers, a collection of stories that explore the intersections between the human and animal worlds, by debut author Hannah Tinti. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Grandpa said, your cousin dead, sitting on the porch.
On the next Fresh Air, Neil Young. We begin a two-part series with the singer and guitarist. He has a new CD and a new movie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Seem like that guy singing this song. He's been doing it.